Hi, Christopher.
Aloha.
Oh, we're joined by the soon-to-be father, the Markster,
The Mark.
the League Master. Congratulations, but well, you know what I mean.
Yeah.
We know what you mean.
Thanks, Chris. How you getting on?
I'm doing very well. I'm just doing a podcast. I've been doing it for quite a while now, shall we say, and 19 months. In fact, but like all good things, it must come to an end.
Yep, like all good things, this is our finale, our farewell episode, the cinema we see.
The cinema we see?
Yeah,
I thought it was the movies we watch.
No, you fool. It's the cinema.
Oh, damn. Oh, there we are. Well, we learn something new every day. So, yes, our final film. What did Mark say? I'm not going to carry on until you tell me.
It's only taken 19 months and close to 70 episodes?
I don't know.
Episodes? Where are you getting this figure from?
What episode would this be now, Chris?
I believe it's 34. Why haven't I written this down?
Well, to be fair, I didn't look beforehand either. I reckon
We're going with 34 because there's no need for an exact figure because I'm sure there's episodes budged in here and there. We probably had to take episodes out due to controversial things we discussed.
No,
so.
I don't think we've ever lost an episode. We've had no complaints.
Brilliant. That's something to celebrate.
And this is a little bit different this episode because we're talking about...
Yeah, we can't be bothered to review a movie, you know, although we're big movie fans, we're like, yeah.
They're talking
whatever,
about
you know.
A plethora of movies, lots and lots of different movies.
Absolutely, yes. I've done my homework as well to make sure that we do discuss a plethora of things, definitely.
So I thought we could start with our favourite first-time watches of the last 12 months, and then in the second half, we can discuss our favourite re-watches of the last 12 months.
Can I just write that down? So first half, you said favourite, what was that, sorry?
First time watches.
And the second half?
Would be favourite rewatches.
Favourite rewatches. Okay, I don't really rewatch films though.
I thought you were a fan of rewatches.
I don't know where you would have gotten that impression from. I might have just said it to you so you liked me at some point.
He's already taken, Chris.
I'm aware of that.
Well, anyway, so we'll kick off.
Oh, no, I do have a rewatch.
You do have a rewatch?
It's sorted now. Crisis averted.
So how about, we'll go with first time watches. I'll start if that's okay. And then we'll take in turns. So I'll mention one and then you can mention one.
And then whoever can't mention another one loses.
Pretty much.
I'll keep speaking.
Okay.
Or I'll just keep talking. I mean, I can talk forever. So with my first one I want to talk about, it's actually, I think, would be a good double bill, personally, because I watched them several months between each other. But I think that they go well together if anyone wanted to watch them back to back. So the two films are Into the Wild, directed by Sean Penn from 2007, and The Straight Story, directed by David Lynch, from 1999. Now, these films are automatically favourites, and it surprised me because I'm not really one for sort of road movies. I'm not sure. I mean, I have, maybe because I'm not much of a sort of adventurous traveler kind of living.
Yeah, that's
wild.
The thing, if an avid cinema fan tends to remain very stationary.
Exactly, but I really, really took to these films. So a little bit about Into the Wild. It stars Emile Hirsch, who I'm a big fan of. Most recently I saw him in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which came out in 2019. But he's been in tons of stuff like Lords of Dogtown and Alpha Dog and Milk. He plays a real-life person called Chris McCandless, who in late 80s, early 90s, he's got this sort of bright future ahead of him because he just graduated from an Ivy League school, but he decides to try and travel to Alaska. So he goes through all the different states and he's living off very little money and that kind of thing. And it's got an ending that really knocks you out because we're always kind of working towards this ending. It's one of those films that's not completely linear. And when you get to it, it's just, it made me cry. And then the second film, The Straight Story, again, also made me almost well up at the end, is the least Lynchian film I think he's ever done. You would never guess it was David Lynch if you didn't know he directed it before you watched it, because it hasn't got a lot of his sort of staples of being dreamlike or strange sort of characters. Again, based on a true story by a man called Alvin Straight, who rode a lawnmower from Iowa all the way to Wisconsin to see his brother. And it's Sissy Spacek plays his daughter, and she's got some really good scenes. And it's just a really quiet sort of film about, you know, the lengths humans can go to sort of see the world and grow as individuals. And so I just think that.
So both of these films, both of your favorite first time watches.
Yes.
Are these your top favorite first time watches?
No, I got a few that I.
Oh, in no particular order. Well, these are both biographies.
Yeah, they're both biographies. Yeah.
That's interesting. And is it? Can we say that there's a message in a biography? What would be the message of these stories if they were trying to convey one, do you think?
Well, that's what I like about these two, is they're not cradle to the grave kind of pictures, and also not giving too much away, but the main characters, I believe, had passed away by the time their films came out. So, you know, in some things you have people saying, oh, I want you to include that, I don't want you including that. So, I mean, don't get me wrong, their families have a lot of say in these things, and rightly so, but I just feel like there's not really a message apart from what you take from it as you're watching it. This is definitely not hammering home anything, I don't think.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, that's just interesting stories, I suppose, then, that people would be intrigued by. And it's interesting that you mentioned about these films being released posthumously, because I suppose at that point, nobody should have any illusions about the subjects of the film. So you're going to get a more, or I'd like to think you have something more authentic, genuine. But then again, it could also be the case that if the people are in question are deceased, then people might not want to talk ill of the dead if that has to happen. So yeah, it could work both ways. In these films, do you think they shied away from controversy, or if you would know this, if they tried to portray the subjects in a good light, or
I think that they're quite good at showing the warts and all of both people. So Chris in Into the Wild and Alvin in The Straight Story, I think another thing that occurred to me was because they are real people, but then they weren't sort of names you'd immediately recognize. They weren't celebrities or anything like that. You might have read about them in the newspaper at the time, but if it's years and years later and, you know, it's not something that's, it's not Churchill. So it's not as difficult.
Having said that, though, there's lots of school kids who, if you ask them who Churchill is, you're going to get back an answer of a dog that sells insurance. So
they changed that advert now. I'm gutted because I love the old advert.
Well, the Churchill.
Yeah. The dog. Yeah, it was iconic, wasn't it? Now it's all probably CGI.
Yeah, it's like
The worst one was a Halifax man when he turned the Halifax man into a CGI. The Halifax man is still alive.
Howard CGI?
Yeah, Howard CGI. They CGI'd him.
I'm going to have to YouTube that because I haven't seen that.
I'm not sure I know that.
Extra, extra. You know you want more. Do you not remember this, Gabby?
I don't think
probably too young. Probably too young.
I don't think.
Yeah,
you'll see. You'll...
It probably wasn't on maybe.
Okay. Well, after this episode, I will have a look at the Halifax advert. So, what's one of your favorite first time watches, Chris?
Ooh, it's a very, very difficult. You know, I hate making choices. Really. I want to try and suggest one of our independent films.
One we've already reviewed?
No, what I mean is a film from an independent producer rather than a big blockbuster.
Oh, right.
Well, the thing is, I'm going to have to go with the big blockbuster. I'm going to say the Joker film, 2019. Are we talking about films this year?
It's something you watched in the last 12 months.
Damn it. Let me try again.
We can talk about Joker if you want, because you'd be giving...
Nah, I've broken the rules.
No, it's okay, but we can talk about it if you want.
We'll go back to that one.
Okay.
I loved What We Do in the Shadows, a comedy, and we don't mention comedies that often on our podcast, but What We Do in the Shadows wasn't just good as a comedy. I also think it was very well written and was very intriguing. And I think they portray the vampire lore in an intelligent and, like I said before, intriguing way. And I just enjoyed it. What can I say? It's got comedy. It's interesting. And it's one of those films where you actually want there to be a sequel.
Yeah, I mean, there is the TV series, which we really enjoyed season one, didn't we?
Really good show, yeah. I highly recommend that.
Season two is going to be good.
Because not only does it have, I think I said this at the time when I reviewed it, not only does it have potential, well, it is a comedy, so not only does it have potential as a comedy, going in for another sequel, but also has potential for its story and it being a more dramatic and profound film as well. The film was done very well and it allows the director and the producers to take it in a number of different directions, which is that's exactly what you want from a film. I don't know what else you would want from a film.
You know, I kind of like that some people are choosing now to, instead of make a sequel feature-length film, they're making a sequel TV series. I mean, look at Mark and I are currently watching WandaVision, which is a sequel basically to the MCU, and it opens up storytelling, doesn't it? You can focus on different people, more low-key kind of storytelling, and you can expand the world a lot better sometimes when you jump around between feature films and TV shows, you know?
I think that's one disadvantage that films have in comparison to books and television series is the world-building aspect. The thing is, there is more media coming out now, like computer games, where the world-building aspect, the potential for it is tremendous. And what's happening is that films which are by their design meant to be feature length and they're meant to occur over a limited amount of time, say, and that 2 hours, 3 hours, that disadvantage stands out. You're not getting the same level of immersion that you are with the forms of media. And now you're also getting VR headsets that allow other forms of live entertainment. And I think cinema is going to be left behind in that regard. I think certain producers, directors, etc., have tried to overcome this by always saying that, oh, we're going to have three films in this installment. So like the Star Wars films, there was three of them.
Oh, yeah.
With The Hobbit, there was three of them. But then those are bad examples because there's too many of them.
Well, what about the thought of immersive films? Because they tried to divulge into 3D films. This was when
I
Avatar
hate
3D.
Came
up. But
yeah, the thing is, Mark, 3D is bad.
But this is it. Once VR becomes more commercially available, what would your views be on an actual VR film? Because you guys
that's,
are right.
Well, that's like 4D, isn't it? Like back in the day.
But 4D, but, like you would with a VR headset. So you'd basically go into the cinema, you'd have the stick your headset on, and effectively you are in the film.
So the thing is, Mark, what you've done is you've raised a point that I wanted to raise at the end of this podcast as well about the future of cinema. And so this is very interesting because although people aren't be able to go to cinemas or not as they were able to before, what people could do is use this new VR headset technology that's coming out, and it's improving at a rapid pace. My co-workers who were born in the 1960s own VR headsets, and they know how to use them, and they're talking about how brilliant they are. And I was thinking, it's so simple. Get a VR headset, put on your head. As long as it's comfortable, then you could have a cinema experience. You could look to the person next to you, could be your friend coming next to you, or some avatar your friend, and then it would be like being in the cinema. As for, I've even got the smell of a cinema covered as well. And I was researching...
What, sweat?
Just wait a minute, I've got here. Yeah, so I was thinking, what actually gives a cinema itself smell? It's popcorn, isn't it? It's the popcorn that gives that cinema smell. Do you know what I'm talking about, Gabby?
Yeah, totally. Popcorn is the main one.
There is a substance. It's called flavacol seasoning popcorn salt.
The yellow stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Flavacol. And as for the other smells, well, we can do without those. And that's an advantage. So if you wanted to have the flavacol popcorn smell on Amazon, I don't really recommend you ordering food items from the internet. Well, eBay or Amazon, but it is here, and you might not be consuming it. You might just be smelling it. So yeah, I suppose you could get it.
I mean,
you put your VR headset on, get this carton of flavacol, open it up and huff it.
Well, I feel like what I miss the most is the lights dimming. That was always my favorite bit. Because then you knew that you were all like in, it was like, it's, you know, it was Ziggy's dimming the lights in our living room.
Yeah, it's just demonstrating that the experience can be replicated.
Yeah. But that's, see, well, yeah, I mean.
It's not the same, is it?
It's not the same. It's like what you were saying about your flavicle.
my flavicle. That's brilliant.
Anyway, so we're going to get through a few more first-time watches.
I said clavicle.
Clavicle.
I don't... Yeah.
We're going to get through a few more first-time watches, so...
It became a discussion. It's like those meetings at work where you come to discuss an agenda and it just becomes a discussion. So back to the first-time watch. So I mentioned one, which was What We Do in the Shadows.
Yep.
Should I say who it's by as well?
All right, because people can...
Taika Waititi.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People can...
Yeah, What We Do in the Shadows by Taika Waititi.
Yes.
And it's the vampire satire.
People
anyway, so I'm going
back to our episode we did on it. So we're going to mention a few that we've not mentioned before. Well, I might have mentioned them off the cuff, but anyway, so... By the way, I am 37 weeks pregnant, so if I take sudden deep breath, please bear with me. Ziggy says he's got a first-time watch ready. You can go after me if you want, yeah? Okay, right, so I'm going to lump these two together again because they're both documentaries, very different documentaries, mind you. I want to talk about Bowling for Columbine from 2002 and Super Size Me 2, Holy Chicken from 2017. Very different films here, but they're all about I was gonna say the culture of America. No, they're not.
What's
all
that?
About...
mass murder and overeating.
No, but
Jesus Christ, Gabby.
I mean, I'm not American myself.
You should be the ambassador to America.
I'm not American myself. Never grown up in America.
It's all right,
but I do find it interesting that. It's made
just fat people shooting
Chris,
each other.
Let me talk.
I'm sorry, I'll stop now.
Interesting that they are made by. I was going to say made by Americans, but actually, I think they might be Canadians. I beg your pardon, but I managed to catch myself. So, the thing is, beginning with Bowling for Columbine, if you know the inspiration behind the documentary, it was a school shooting, a high school shooting. In 1999, two boys went in. They killed, I believe, 12 students and a teacher. And the thing was, I believe it was one of the first sort of school shootings of that scale at that time. And unfortunately, after 1999, there have been more school shootings that have kind of mimicked Columbine, but Columbine was one of the first. So the documentarian, or yeah, it is Michael Moore. He's done a range of things. This is one of his sort of middle of his career, early to middle of his career. And it had me hooked immediately just from his sort of persona. For example, he decides to start the film by seeing in a newspaper an article that says, if you open a bank account with us, we'll give you a free gun. So he goes, okay. So he goes to this bank. He does all the paperwork and everything. All the cameras are in there and watching him go through it. And then at the very end, the lady hands over the counter a gun to him. And he says to her, like, in a very sort of, you know, sort of dry sense of humor, he says, really strange to be receiving a gun in a bank, you know, when you think about bank robberies and all that kind of thing. And she just is completely blank. She does not understand what he is implying at all. And that really sets you up for the rest of the film, because the film is about the sort of irony, the very unfortunate irony of how the American attitude to guns. For example, you could buy bullets at the local Kmart and all that sort of thing. And there's a great bit where he interviews Charlton Heston, because Charlton Heston was sort of the... he was one of the leaders of the National Rifle Association. And unfortunately, coincidence or not, whenever there was a big shooting in a city, Charlton Heston would show up and do a "Aren't rifles great?" kind of speech. And it was very strange, and he does call him out on that. But no, I find it a very fascinating film. It's aged well, I'd say, because, you know, there's still so many problems all over the world with gun crime, but it does discuss America versus the world in terms of gun crime, because there's this attitude of, well, Americans, we've got this history of, you know, coming in and taking over and all that. And it's like, well, yeah, but so many other countries do. So why do you have more of a problem with gun crime than anyone else? So I just think that that is definitely one to go back to. If you've never seen it, if you've seen it, but it was many years ago, Bowling for Columbine. So the next one, which has a lot more laughs in, I will say, is Holy Chicken. I can't remember the guy, Morgan.
Holy Chicken, is this an abbreviation of the title, yeah, of the film, because you mentioned it Super Size Me Too, Holy Chicken.
Yeah, Ziggy will look up his name. It's Morgan something. And this film, you know, I'd say it would be quite hard to do a sequel to Super Size Me, which came out in 2004, because that is an absolute classic, especially of my generation. I was 9 years old when it came out.
Morgan Spurlock
is his name. And but I just remember watching that documentary with my friends when we were like 10. And it was more for the fun of watching a guy doing like an eating challenge. But it also told us so much about like why mum and dad say one McDonald's a month or something. Because of the kind of stuff it can do to your body, that fast food. The sequel is about how in the last sort of 10 years, it's been a huge push for healthier options. So vegan, organic, and all that kind of thing. And he explores that and sees if it actually is a lot better or if it's just these fancy words. And he explores a lot of different things, but his main goal is not an eating challenge this time, but is to open his own organic restaurant. And it's full of just classic one-liners. And
organic fast food restaurant.
Yes, organic fast food restaurant. Because he was saying how now in McDonald's you can like get carrot sticks, whilst 20 years ago you couldn't really. So yeah, we watched that one night and it was just a good sort of laugh. But at the end of it, you do think, oh, I've got more of a different perspective on what is trying to be sold to me.
I think another thing to add to that as well is the sheer sort of dictatorship that a lot of the big corporations have that effectively downgrade the little man who does all the work, whereas all the big companies essentially gain all the profit and penalise those that are really having a bad day, so to speak, because we know full well that anything that is a livestock or growth, for example, is prone to fluctuations and everything like that. And it was an interesting segment where Big Chicken was the main sort of highlight of the show when it came to the organisational things. And I wouldn't spoil too much of it, but effectively when they found out about the farmers helping Morgan to create his own farm against the corporation, and the corporation came down on that farm, and it was an interesting sort of insight into how big corporations can effectively control and spread that level of fear throughout an honest living. So that was also quite a...
Why were they afraid of the big company then, the big corporation?
Because the fact of the matter is, it was their livelihood. And
because the corporations knew it was their livelihood, they knew that they had so much power over them.
And they could control them through lack of levies, giving them less produce to work with and giving them less money to live off of.
They could sabotage their own employees if the employees did anything to upset them. They could just give more work to other employees because, they had so many minions under them.
And what was interesting about that was it was stumbled across by Morgan when he was creating the chicken farm, because he wanted to go from farm to table. And the evolution of the documentary is something that I highly recommend people to watch, because it goes as starting from one thing and evolves into something completely different.
Mm.
And the connection between all moving parts of the documentary ties in really well.
Yeah. And what I like was he could have made Super Size Me 2 like a couple of years after he did the first one, but he waited until he had like a proper reason to do another one. Like, it's so good when filmmakers have the patience to just let the world change before coming back into a situation, because you have way more to discuss. And there was a great bit where they were doing research by going to different fast food restaurants to see the layout and that kind of thing. And when they pull into the car park of McDonald's, he's like, this is almost like PTSD, this. But no, it's really good.
Okay, I'm going to address an issue with both of these films together. To what extent do these films present the alternate point of view? So what I mean is there an agenda? Is it just one agenda? Or is there some self-awareness? Is there some attempt to address criticism?
Well, I think the Super Size Me one, especially with Morgan,
because we watched that one together,
I mean, I'd address that and say probably yes. I mean,
in terms of an agenda,
but then the fact that the actual movie itself can think very quickly on its feet. And the one thing that I found quite interesting, to answer your question, Chris, was that the people who were trying to help Morgan create this organic fast food restaurant couldn't actually quite believe that he was going for fried chicken. So they, even then he was taking that criticism on board, but then still rolling with it. So in a way, yes, they did have an agenda. And I don't know what you'd say for...
Yeah, I'd say there was an agenda, yeah.
But I think that they addressed in that film particularly what could be viewed as the other side of things,
mm-hmm.
in so much as fast food is not good for you, but it can be better for you than what it was.
Yes, it does more or less say that it is so much better than what it was. But he just says, like, be wary of how they are trying to get you. Like, when he does open up his own organic restaurant, some of the stuff he says to the customers is just, and to see their reactions is fantastic. There's a bit where this woman, she's got to the front of the line and Morgan's serving people at the cash register, and she gets to the front of the line, and she's looking at some of the decor, and Morgan says something like, do you like the wood? Because there's wood paneling underneath the counter, and he says, it's to make you think of barns. And it's just terrific.
Did they, I'm a bit intrigued about, I have to draw a line with this at some point. Did it compare the prices that he sold his product for compared to the prices that the fast food chains? I know his would be more, but is that an element of it?
Yeah, I think a little bit they talk about that.
Not a great deal, though.
No, it's more about what's actually in the food rather than... Oh, and the marketing. They talk about the marketing of this new way of eating a lot, which is, again, very interesting. Those are the two documentaries that I watched that I thought were really good. Mark, did you say that there was one you wanted to mention?
I'll throw The Apartment into the room for me.
You want to talk about The Apartment? Why are you going out of the room?
I can get a drink, but I timed it very poorly.
Okay, will you get a drink while Chris says his, and then we'll talk about The Apartment.
Yeah.
So we're still on our favourite first time
watches. That's right, yeah.
And I wanted to mention the joke. I wasn't able to because, of course, it had broken the rules about it being a year. Don't worry about that. So mentioned Sorry, my mind's gone blank. Yeah, so mentioned Taika Waititi's What We Do in the Shadows. I find it so hard to say, really, because I feel that films have advantages and disadvantages. And there are some ones I don't like, but then there are many that I think do hit the mark. I'm going to go with Patterson 2016. We reviewed this back in September of last year, and the reason why, I should say a bit about the film, it stars Adam Driver as a bus driver named Patterson, who lives in Patterson, and it's just a feel-good film. It's a positive feel-good film. I'll admit it's not strong in story, but it's, I think the world building's good. I think it has a very good atmosphere to it. And if you just wanted a film where you could relax and feel good for the characters and imagine what life might be like somewhere else, then I would recommend this film. It's the best film I know that is in this genre. What were your thoughts on it, Gabby? Do you think it particularly stood out?
Yeah.
Or
it was a few months ago that we reviewed it on the podcast, but I liked it a lot. It was a rewatch for me because I'd seen it maybe, I don't know, 12 months before that. But I did like it because it is one of those films you do need to have patience, but if you do sit through it all, you're rewarded at the end. I think it's got a strong ending. And
yeah, I think it's a film where you've got to be in a certain mood to enjoy it. If you're in a mood where you want something dramatic and profound, then you won't enjoy it. If you're in the mood where you want something fast-paced, action-packed, you're not going to enjoy it either. But if you're in a mood where you just want to chill out, want to relax, want to take it easy, you feel like you're on top of everything and you want to celebrate that, then Patterson fits the bill. And I think it gets mentioned for me because it's doing something different. At least it's doing something different because, like I said, other films are either fast-paced, action-packed, or they're deep to the basically melancholy. Whereas this does something different.
Yeah, I feel like it's quite unique. The only other film I can think of that reminds me of Patterson is Barfly with Mickey Rourke from the 80s, I believe. So that's one to throw into the, what do you call it? Throw into the
ring.
Yes. If you like Patterson, then watch Barfly. If you like Barfly, then watch Patterson. Yeah.
I know Gabby's mentioning films two at a time. I'm going to mention them one at a time.
Well, that's okay. It's just how my brain works. But But what?
Okay. You got two halves to your brain, and one half of your brain thinks something, the other half is thinking something else.
I'm a jumper arounder kind of person.
A jumper arounder.
But I, if it's right with you, Chris, are we able to move on to Ziggy, one of Ziggy's favourites as well?
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah, I'm too excited. Go ahead.
Now, one of the main reasons why I loved The Apartment was, you know, there was a nostalgia reason, because it was the film that Gabby watched on her hen do. And you've been meaning to show us for quite a while, hadn't you?
Yeah.
And again, it's not typically the film that I would have watched by myself. And I'm sure one of the things, you know, that has been great that you'd agree with, Chris, and in knowing Gabby, is that she pushes you towards things that originally, if you off your own back, you wouldn't even consider watching. And you realise, looking back on it, how much of a fool you were for not actually doing it in the first place. And I think, because for me with The Apartment, it was a really good story for something that originally I would have looked at as being so mundane. But
It's one of those films that tricks you into thinking it's a lot simpler than it is.
Hmm.
So quick background, The Apartment, directed by Billy Wilder, came out in 1960, won Best Picture. It stars Jack Lemmon and Shirley MacLaine and Fred McMurray. And, you know, it's black and white and that kind of thing. And it does, like, it's got a very simple title. And if you knew that Billy Wilder did Some Like It Hot the year before, you might think it would be similar in terms of comedy, which it isn't at all. The comedy is very different. And it's one of those films that for the year it came out, you're surprised the kind of things they're willing to touch on. So they talk, you know, not too sort of subtly about sex, suicide, sort of affairs and all that kind of thing. And you're watching it and you're thinking, wow, they're really talking about these things, and you wouldn't expect it with a film that's so, you know, it's 61 years old this year. But no, it's just got such great performances. A lot of the jokes landed for you, I believe. Yeah. And
which is strange for a film of that generation. I think we've watched two or three together and a lot of the jokes haven't landed as much. Although there was one, the drunk scene in that. Oh, what's the film? Is it with Cary Grant?
Cary Grant. Yeah. Oh, North by Northwest.
That was quite funny. And I think it's the fact that I've appreciated, especially with The Apartment, that you can have humour in a film that is, you know, not meant to be humorous.
Yes, sort of, you can have humour, and it's just a master of tone, The Apartment. Like, one moment, you're not laughing at all. You're just stone cold watching something that's very upsetting or distressing or something like that. And then the next moment, you're laughing because the characters are just so... There's something in the characters that's just so likable, isn't it? Especially Jack Lemmon and Shirley MacLaine. And you can kind of... It was a really good film to watch in my hen do, actually, because when there were bits where people were being bad, we all kind of were yelling at the screen like, oh, he's such a, you know...
We weren't at that stage, though, Chris, because, of course, I was the only one drinking, and I felt wrong if I got to that level of drunkenness.
Yeah. Oh, and it's the film that takes place around New Year's Eve, which I think is a really great film to watch near New Year's Eve, you know, annually, maybe.
Are we sure about this? You just described it to me as being about sex and suicide, and just because it occurs in New Year's Eve doesn't mean that it will be
it's an appropriate really film for New Year's Eve. Film. It tells you, like, to stand for yourself and to, you know, it tells you to stand up for yourself.
I mean, there wasn't any suicide in there.
There was a suicide attempt.
Suicide attempt, but so if you take a little
bit, oh, okay,
effectively right, a New Year's film when you mention that sex is at the end, so.
I think you've assessed and analysed the film very well. Actually.
As you can tell,
I have no questions.
Definitely one of the favourite films that Gabby wanted to show me, and I'm really glad she did.
Hey, that's what we do here.
Okay. Yeah, The Apartment.
We do some recommendations.
Speaking of The Apartment, how's your house, Chris?
Yeah.
I haven't moved in yet. Is the answer. I'm slowly but surely getting the furniture in. I just need a TV and a TV stand now, but I do need to put some blinds in on all the windows. And the thing is that if I had to pay someone to put the blinds in, it would be extortionately expensive. So I'm going to do it myself. But the problem with doing it myself is I don't want to put a blind up and then screw it up, or put a blind in and then the edge of the blind being too far from the window. And I can't measure it. And
is the this, or do you want somebody to come and give you a hand?
No, it's I'll do it. Wow. Yeah.
You'll get there.
What
yeah.
can I say?
Well, I just want to rattle off very quickly some other first-time watches, but I won't go into too much detail because we'll move on to rewatches. Well, after you've said your last first-time watch as well. So the ones I just want to quickly rattle off are The Farewell from 2019, directed by Lulu Wang. A great film about family coming together over, you know, when family especially needs to come together, when there's sort of, you know, illness in the family. Next one is A Quiet Place from 2018. I loved that film. And I really didn't think I was going to like it as much as I did, because it did get good reviews. But a lot of people kind of said that it was the type of thriller that a lot of people...
Thrills.
Sorry?
The type of thriller that thrills. Sorry, just carry on. Being silly.
It didn't really, I don't know why, but at the time, a couple of years ago, I just thought it didn't sound like it was for me. Anyway, I did watch it, I think it was in April of 2020. And I was just so impressed with how it builds tension. It's just excellent, A Quiet Place. Next, a double bill. Both directed by Bong Joon-ho, Mother from 2009 and The Host from 2006.
Yes, actually. They're very interesting films. Actually, the second one, The Host, is topical.
It is topical. It's about...
That's the word I need to describe
it.
It starts being topical when... Anyway, sorry, I'll let you
well,
explain.
Well, with The Host, I'm glad you mentioned it's topical, because it is about sort of this man-made virus which first manifests itself as a literal monster that comes out of the river in Seoul.
Yeah, that's when it stops being topical, when the giant monster appears.
Well, no, that's not the topical.
Still time.
Ziggy's like, there's still time. For it to completely mirror our own reality. But no, The Host, yeah, I mean, I know a lot of people with the coronavirus went through a phase of watching Contagion, the Steven Soderbergh film, and some people watched 1995's Outbreak. But, you know, if you want to stay clear of all that kind of stuff, then maybe put off The Host for another few years. But Mother is nothing to do with viruses. And that's a... It's murder mystery. It's about a woman who thinks her son's been framed for murder, so she conducts her own investigations. And no spoilers. No,
well,
no,
you
I
can
don't
if you want.
Spoil.
I thought no, you were going to. No. So.
And okay. It's very dark. I mean, like Parasite. If you're a fan of Parasite, and you can deal with how sometimes he gets a little bit gory and kind of like, ooh, like some stuff can be very, very, you know, spine tingling with some of his work. Like if you've seen Snowpiercer and some of the things they touch on there. But if you can manage other Bong Joon-ho films, then I think you can cope with Mother.
It's not gratuitous. It's not like films where they go over the top.
It could be, but he doesn't quite make it gratuitous, which is good.
And I've like said, I've watched both of those films, and I think that they're very similar to Western films. Actually, The Host is very similar to a Western film. It's similar to Godzilla in a way. I describe it as a monster film, Godzilla film. And I think that there are advantages over other films in the genre in that with the host, the characters are done much better. Seem to have more depth to them. They're not just your usual see monster, scream, be afraid. The characters are intelligent and they think about the situation more like an actual person would when they're in that situation.
Yeah, you know, and it has that classic Bong Joon-ho sense of humor. There's a bit where the family they're crying. They're upset because something's happened to one of their family members, and then there's like three or four family members who are together after the event, and they're all sobbing, but they're sobbing like little children. And you could just be like, oh, this is cringy, but it's just hysterical. It's just, they are great films, Mother and the Host. And, you know, I think people are really sitting up to his filmography, Bong Joon-ho, after winning, and deservedly winning, Best Picture last year. Very quickly, the very last one I want to mention before we move on to rewatches is I want to pay tribute to Kirk Douglas, who passed away last year. Because he's known for so many things like The Bad and the Beautiful, Spartacus, Out of the Past. He's been in so many things. But my personal now favourite of Kirk Douglas is a film called Lonely Are the Brave that he did. It came out in 1962. It was written by Dalton Trumbo, who was, he was on the blacklist in terms of like... people who were suspected of communism and lost their jobs and that sort of thing. And Don Trumbo is a very good screenwriter. And this film, it has this terrific pace to it. And it's one of those films where you just don't know where it's going at all, because it hasn't got a very clear cut sort of, beginning, middle, end. And there's a long sequence that takes place in a prison cell where two characters are just talking. And Kirk Douglas is just so good in the role where he plays this guy who's trying to still be a cowboy in 1962. And it's not really the world's moved on a lot. It's not really the cowboy era anymore. And he's still trying to be that kind of guy, like maybe his father was or his grandfather was. And it's just how the modern world won't let you be that way. So that's my last first time watch I wanted to mention that I want people to seek out, I think.
Yeah, that sounds very interesting, that the film you just mentioned. Could take a note of it again, because I think I'd be very interested in watching.
Yeah, that's Lonely Are the Brave, Kirk Douglas.
Okay, yeah, I'm getting some... I think I'll enjoy that, yeah. It's interesting because my mum was talking to me about the kinds of films that people my family watch. She asked me what my favourite genre was, and after much stalling and hesitation, I said sci-fi, even though none of the films I've suggested are sci-fi. And she was saying that my grandmother liked cowboy films, and my grandmother also said that people dig their graves with their teeth.
What's
their...
Yeah, because we had a lot of fat people in our family. So, yeah.
Oh, that's a metaphor for people eating themselves to death?
Yeah. I don't know where I'm going with this. It's just a nice, pleasant thought. We've actually reviewed a lot of Western films.
Both me and Gabby had a mental image of like old people using false teeth to bury themselves in their graves, which was a bit old.
That's amazing. So... obviously, we love Western films. Actually, I think more than one Clint Eastwood film. We've got High Plains Drifter, which was pretty crazy. And then we had The Beguiled, which is equally as crazy. And it's just those two. I think it's just those two. But I think we didn't just go with the classic Westerns. We went with Westerns which weren't as well known and were also very good to watch, but just never got to the quite the same prominence as, say, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly did. So we're on to first time watches. We're on to rewatches now. So I did want to watch another first time watch. I wanted to mention Nosferatu as well, the film before last we reviewed, just because it was one of the first films that was ever released in 1922. But I'm amazed at how well it's stood the test of time in terms of the visuals, in terms of the story is based upon the Count Dracula, so you know you've got an intriguing story there. And also, because it was a silent film, it can have a quality of life improvement with new orchestra score added to it. So Nosferatu's 1922, don't be put off by the fact that it's a very old film. It's really withstood the test of time. If you just want to watch a good film, watch it. But if you're also interested in cinematography, in filmography, in the history of cinema, you have to watch it. So on to...
Yeah, I'm still...
You're still there, Gabby? So on to rewatches. So I should really go first since you went first in the last section. And I'm going to go with Apocalypse Now. The thing is, Apocalypse Now is a cult classic. So it's not really a surprise for me to mention it. And everybody knows how great the film is. But the reason why I think it's a very good film to rewatch is because there's so much depth to it. If you just watch it the first time, you're going to be looking at, you're going to remember most the classic lines, like, Charlie, don't surf. But when you watch it the second time and you're expecting all these scenes, etc., you then start to see the deeper aspect of it. And for me, that deeper aspect was watching a man who was very promising, and the officer, Colonel Kurtz, he was very, very promising, very capable, but then you see how that person could also be naive, and although he had all the qualifications, it was great in paper, when he was put in to a difficult situation, his vulnerabilities became clear. He was a bit of a perfectionist. He was too naive, and when he saw the horrors of the world, he became immediately disillusioned, cynical, and he wasn't able to cope with what he experienced, so he went off the deep end. And I think there's a moral to it. It's like a modern mythology. It's a story with the moral. Don't be a perfectionist, and the best of us can be naive, and you only really know until we're tested.
Great choice, though. I'm surprised you didn't mention Captain Marvel as your rewatch, Chris.
Could we not mention?
How many times have you watched this film?
So I want to talk about the state of cinema, but it would be a bit too depressing. Yeah. So I've already mentioned about Captain Marvel and why.
We'll talk a little bit about future cinema at the end, even though at the moment it just seems everything is delayed. But we will talk about that a little bit at the end.
Just imagine the world of cinema was a beautiful valley with happy bunnies bouncing up and down, and COVID was a nuclear bomb.
I think future cinema is just studios moving the goalposts in terms of release dates, and that's pretty much it, really. I want to mention a few rewatches for me, but they were first time watches from Mark here, because I all of a sudden, at different points over the last year, said, "Oh, you have to see this." Now, the thing is, with me, I think my weakest genre to recommend to anybody is comedy. It's definitely comedy. My sense of comedy is a required taste. And
acquired,
sorry.
Unless and, you're directing that at me.
but I do like to recommend comedies and watch them with Ziggy, because I like to just see how badly it lands, or be pleasantly or be pleasantly surprised of how well it lands. So the three I'm going to mention are Game Night from 2018, Bob Carroll, Ted and Alice from 1969, and Bridesmaids from 2011. So I don't know if you heard Ziggy just now in the background to each one, but I'd say...
Okay, okay.
Yeah,
and
I'd say two
up.
Out of three.
Two out of three.
The one thing that has obviously been difficult with this whole COVID thing is that you've not been over here to watch films with us, Chris.
I know, it's very sad. We did do one in the summer when the Rule of Six.
We did, but I think...
Applied. In a COVID-safe way. I mean, they don't like getting too close to me anyway.
It would have been entertaining for you to sit with us for Bob, Ted and Alice especially.
Oh, that would have been so entertaining. Oh, my gosh.
But definitely Bridesmaids and Game Night. Game Night, I think, surprised me the most.
Well, interestingly, you know, Bridesmaids and Game Night are from the same decade, the 2010s, whilst Bob, Carroll, Ted and Alice is from the late 60s. And it's like what we were talking about, the apartment, that... You know, the humour in that worked for both me and Ziggy, whilst Bob Carroll, Ted and Alice, the humour, I'd say more worked for me than for Ziggy. And I think the reason being is I'm a big lover of satire, and I can watch something and just, if I'm sort of like 20 minutes into it, sometimes something will go off in my brain and I'll go, this is a satire. And, you know, everything they're saying is meant to sort of provoke. And I can kind of deal with that and roll with it and just accept that what they are saying to me is very outlandish and not actually... They're not trying to have real characters is what I'm trying to say. The characters are based on... real kind of people you would have met at that time or whatever, but they are sort of blown up to be a lot more cartoonish. But I'm all right with that. I can accept that. But watching Ziggy, he was like, and the thing is that the situation, so a little bit about Bob, Carroll, Ted and Alice, a favorite of Quentin Tarantino, if anyone cares about that kind of thing, is that it's about this couple who go to retreat. The kind of retreats are very popular in the, you know, hippie years, where they learn to love one another and themselves. And they come back home. I believe they live in Los Angeles. And they meet up with their friends, one of them being Elliot Gould, who I adore. And their friends haven't had this experience on this retreat. So when... Bob and Carol come back and they're kind of, they've changed and they're very like affectionate and open and that kind of thing. Ted and Alice are a bit just like, what? And over the course of the film, it's about that friction between people, between a married couple who are very open about love and sex and all that kind of thing against a couple who haven't, who really don't have the kind of like sort of loose way of thinking, possibly because they didn't have this retreat experience at the beginning of the film. And yeah, Ziggy was just like, I don't know what I'm watching, but I love Bob Carroll, Ted and Alice. Bridesmaids was a hit. Classic lines in Bridesmaids, Kristen Wiig, Melissa McCarthy. Yeah. And also I'd been quoting it for years, but Ziggy didn't know where the quotes were from. So he got to find out where they came from. But no, Bridesmaids is a classic. I think a lot of people still watch it now, even though it's 10 year anniversary this year of Bridesmaids. But I think it's Kristen Wiig at the top of her game, Melissa McCarthy at the top of her game. Rose Byrne's very good in it as well. And I think it's one of those kind of stories that will never get old about... two friends who've grown up together and one's getting married and the other one feels like she's being left behind in terms of like her career, her, you know, being in relationships and all that kind of thing. And I think Bridesmaids totally works with guys and is popular with guys as well. And it made a ton of money in 2011 because, you know, a lot of men and women enjoyed it. And then the last one, Game Night. Again, Jason Bateman, he's been doing really good stuff recently. I know there's a lot of lifelong Jason Bateman fans. Like, he was on Arrested Development and that kind of thing. And Rachel McAdams, I just think, is terrific. I think this is her best comedy role since Mean Girls, about a group of friends who think they're going to have their stereotypical game night, and it actually turns into something very different. But no, so those are my favourite three comedy rewatches of the last 12 months.
Okay, and I'm just going to share my own thoughts about comedy and the nature of rewatching. It's interesting because I would never put a comedy in a rewatch. And that also links into what I think a film needs to have, its ingredients, in order to be a successful comedy. The thing about comedy is that it has to subvert expectations. I think that's the basis of comedy, even to the point where it has to be controversial. If you think about all the best comedies, either they include small elements of single jokes where your expectations are subverted, or expectations subverted on a wider scale. So, as an example, we've reviewed, I'll give an example where you have short bursts of subverted expectations. We've reviewed Shaun of the Dead, and the way that subverts expectations is because you're faced with a zombie apocalypse, but then that's also contrasted, a very serious situation is contrasted with how nonchalant the characters are and how ordinary the characters are and how the... It's very hard to put your finger on, but rather than the characters having their minds focused on a mission and being very professional and absolutely serious, you can see how when they're in that situation, they're cracking jokes themselves, and how drama between the characters is being created while there's a zombie outside the window banging at it to get in. So that's one reason why I think Shaun of the Dead was very good. Taiki Waititi's, I'm going to mention it again, What We Do in the Shadows. There's a subversion of expectations there as well, because you expect vampires to be ruthless, predatory, but the humour comes from just being ordinary people who live in a house together and they get into arguments like normal housemates do, but then a moment later they're doing vampire stuff. So that's the origin of the human there. And I think where comedies fail is when people try to write comedies that don't subvert expectations, where there are comedies that follow the status quo. They're trying to make jokes, but they're trying to do it by not risking being controversial. And those are the comedies which don't really end up as comedies.
Well, I think the most common thread between what makes a comedy good is a great cast. So you might be a huge Adam Sandler fan. You might be a huge Adam Sandler fan, and you'll notice that the same people basically show up in all of his films. You could be a huge Judd Apatow film. Why don't you say that? Baby brain. Big fan of Judd Apatow, and you'll recognize that quite often Seth Rogen shows up, and Steve Carell, and all that kind of thing. So I do think that if you have a great cast and a great script, of course, you usually nail a comedy. There's a lot of comedy in Robert Altman films,
yes,
and I'm a big Robert Altman fan, but his stuff doesn't always work for everybody. I mean, you could be a Woody Allen fan if you can just forget about his controversies.
Yes, with yeah, I mean, with comedy deliveries, that is very important as well. And I think script's important. But then you say about a cast, I'm not so sure. Because there's no such thing as a funny person, per se. There's people with good delivery who deliver good jokes. And I think if lots of films fail because we fall into the trap of thinking if we get people who've been in other comedies who deliver the lines well, we put them into the films and have a good script. If we have the funny cast, then work out. And I can give examples of that because there's a series in this country called Gavin and Stacey, and it starred an actor called James Corden, and he was very good in Gavin and Stacey. He was funny, objectively funny. I'm not saying funny just to some people, not to others. It was overwhelmingly regarded that he played his character well, and the character was funny, and it was a good comedy. But then he went over to America, and he was trying to tell different jokes. He wasn't subverting expectations. He was really just sticking with the status quo of America, trying to fit in. And that's when he wasn't funny. He became very grating. So I think that's, and he's done lots of films, and they just sort of fallen flat, unfortunately. So I don't think that having a good cast is the first thing that's
important
for a comedy.
Well, I think cast and crew need to click, basically. So I feel like, you know, I really like Charlize Theron when she works with Jason Reitman. I really like Bill Murray when he works with Sofia Coppola. It's, you know, you'll find people who just work so well together, like Clint Eastwood and Don Siegel, who, you know, I know they're not doing comedies, but they just work. And when you see, like, oh, so-and-so is doing a film with so-and-so, you kind of go, oh, that's probably going to work and it's probably going to be great. So that's kind of what I mean with comedies, is if you have people have good chemistry together. I mean, you can't have a, you know, terrible script or whatever you were saying about, you know, James Corden and whatever. But, you know, a lot of the time, if you've got the same ingredients, you'll get, you know, something. You know what I'm trying to say. Anyway, I'll just quickly mention another double bill in rewatches. My rewatches, they're first time watches for Mark here. And that's, these are two crime thrillers. So the first one is Zodiac from 2007, and the second one is Blowout from 1981. I choose these two because Zodiac, for me, when I first saw it, and it was reaffirmed when I saw it again, is just paced so well. The casting of Mark Ruffalo, Robert Downey Jr., Jake Gyllenhaal is all perfect. It's based off a book written by Jake Gyllenhaal's character, the real life, what's his name? Robert Graysmith. Robert Graysmith, who wrote the book Zodiac. They spent, you know, years and years and years writing. Because if you know anything about the Zodiac killings, they went on for a number of years, and he was never officially sort of, no one was proven really to be the Zodiac killer. There was someone that had a strong sense towards the end who they thought it was, but they could never charge them because that person had a heart attack. Spoiler. But the Zodiac is just paced phenomenally, and directed by David Fincher, so it has all of his sort of shine on it. And you thought it was good, didn't you, Z?
Really, really interesting. As I say, I think I'll mirror what you said with how it was paced as well, was another thing I'd add to that, because it was really good. And it,
and it's a long film, but moves fast.
Oh, well, I mean, I don't know if it was, because we watched it during lockdown, didn't we?
We watched it on our 1 year anniversary baby moon.
That was it, yeah. And, you know,
what do you call it?
Basically, our delayed
baby
honeymoon.
It was our delayed honeymoon, but we coincided with our 1 year wedding anniversary. But because I was 20 weeks pregnant, it was like a baby moon as well. And we watched Zodiac in a place that we'd never been
baby
before,
moon.
That had windows that didn't have curtains over them.
Yeah, dodgy locks and all.
And I was like, ah! But it was good, it was good. We
really
loved
good
it.
Film. Yeah.
Oh, and then the second one, Blowout, that's a Brian De Palma film from 1981. It's John Travolta, Nancy Allen, John Lithgow, also known as Lord Farquaad from Trek, and you know, it's about this, John Travolta plays a sound mixer for sort of your 80s crappy slashers, so Friday the 13th knockoffs. And he goes out one night to record wind and trees and all that kind of thing. And it seems very boring. He's got his headset on, he's got his boom mic. But he actually picks up a car, a blowout, yes, that's going over a bridge. But he listens back to the tape and he catches that it seems as if someone actually shot out the tire. And this leads him down a rabbit hole of, you know, conspiracy, and if these people have got a sort of end game in terms of who they're really trying to hurt. And it's got a phenomenal ending that I've heard people say that they actually don't think it's a good ending. I think it's an absolute amazing ending. What did you think of the ending? Without spoiling it, Z.
I can't remember how it went now.
You can't remember, but it's amazing. It's memorable.
So suffice to say, it wouldn't be Mark's recommendation.
What did you think
of fall asleep?
I liked
how drunk was he?
From what I remember.
I think he's just agreeing with me.
From
what he remembers. How much port did was he did he have any port?
No, it was a slow dinner that night. But no,
that's just as bad as anything.
Well, let me say something to trigger Ziggy's memory a little bit. The ending takes place on the 4th of July.
Oh, I
yes,
know.
You know.
So there's a thumbs up from Gabby, and it's acknowledgement
alcohol and rugby for the fact that my brain is a bit slow most of the time.
People, audience, listeners, please do me a little favour. I'll be so grateful. If you can go ahead and watch Blowout and tell me if you dig the ending, because I would love to know.
It was a good ending. I'd say it was a little cliche.
It's cliche now because this film came out in 1981.
This was it, yeah. And unfortunately, it was because of the here and now that it was a little cliche.
Oh.
But
excuse my language, listeners. Bollocks. I'm sorry.
it was clever.
It's the way it's shot as well. Yeah, because Brian De Palma does something, that was popular with Hitchcock films and Orson Welles films, where something far away looks very, very close. And there's a moment where there's two people against a backdrop of fireworks. And it's just one of the best scenes I've ever... The cinematography is, you know... No,
is it really
soppy,
Mark?
It is not soppy.
It's not soppy. It's anything but soppy.
Anything but soppy.
It was cleverly done. And I'd say that.
One thing I want to just ask Ziggy about is, but don't you think, I know you said the word clever, the bookends, that's how you do bookends of a film. You remember how the film opened and his task of what he had to do, that his boss wanted him to do in terms of find a certain new recording. Yeah. So, and then at the end of the film, how he managed to achieve that, but not in the way you thought he would achieve it. We're not gonna spoil anymore. No. But I do think people should go ahead and watch Blowout.
I'll definitely recommend it. If it's the three of us, I'll definitely say watch it, Chris, because it's probably better than I'm doing it justice.
John Travolta is very good in it. He's not singing and dancing. But
yeah,
John
you can
Travolta
hardly remember it. So
you know how he does a lot of crappy films now, John Travolta. And he then did some action films in the 90s that were pretty good, like Broken Arrow and Face Off. And when he first gained popularity in the 70s, he was doing Saturday Night Fever, he was doing Grease. But this is John Travolta in something I think a lot of people wouldn't have seen him in. And he's very good in it. And he should have done more of it, actually.
Okay, so a good
yes.
John Travolta film.
I don't
is he a Scientologist, remind me? Imagine things. Okay, never mind. That's it. As for my own rewatches, like I said, I don't really rewatch films. Perhaps I should rewatch films more, especially films I watched when I was younger, because like I said, you only tend to remember snippets or the one-liners. You don't see the deeper meaning to it when you watch films the first time, actually. I think I'm ready to move on. I know I only mentioned one, but I think the one I mentioned, Apocalypse Now, I want to impress upon people. They've only seen it once.
Yeah, as you know, over the 19 months we've been doing the podcast, I'm a big advocate for the rewatch. I know not everyone has the time to have a rewatch, and sometimes it's like, do I rewatch this or do I first time watch that?
Well, now people are working at home, you know.
another thing I've always been an advocate for, which doesn't always work for everybody, but I like watching films in chunks, like 10 minutes, 20 minutes. I mean, I know a lot of people don't like
it, but... An hour, I understand, an hour I can get, but like 45 minutes if it's a slow film, but 20 minutes?
I know, but it works really? For me. I don't know how I discovered it, but there you go.
Yeah, there are long films which have been about 3 hours that we've reviewed. I think one of them was Uncle Boonmi Records His Past Life. We've got to mention that very quickly. There's a catfish in it. And I don't know how to describe it. It happens
stuff
in the film.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's yeah. Amazing and horrifying
well,
at the same time.
We've gone on for just under an hour and 20. Is that right? Now? Yeah, an hour and 20. So I think we'll more or less start wrapping up.
Yeah, the future of cinema, Smouldering Crater.
I don't know.
Okay,
the problem is, so in the last week or so, No Time to Die has been announced to be moved back to, I want to say, October. A Quiet Place Part 2 has been moved back to September. So things are... Sorry?
No Galaxy Quest 2. No Galaxy Quest 2. That was going to happen, but that's not just been COVID. There's other, like Alan Rickman dying, which has prevented
that
the
that was a really
of that
weird
film.
Segue, Chris.
It was. I wanted Galaxy Quest 2. And I just... And my family wanted it. We wanted it. And, you know... We were thinking about ways that it could happen, and we thought, so let's say Gabby, since you're an expert in films, when an actor dies, have they released films where there's been the new actor after certain scenes, or how can a director
recast.
Deal with that?
I mean,
the death
Richard
of an actor?
Harris was Dumbledore in the first two Harry Potter films, and then they brought in Michael Gambon, I believe his name is, and you know, sometimes you do stunt doubles, for example, like, you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman passed away between Hunger Games films, and they did a bit of CGI, a bit of stunt doubling, and that happens quite a bit. One thing, last year, I tell you now, right, I was in the hotel this time last year, and I was waiting for my friend, and I saw, they had the news on in the bar in the background, and they were announcing, I think Ziggy knows, I think this is when I didn't have to worry about coronavirus. And this is the thing that upset me the most on the news. It was saying that they wanted to cast James Dean in a new film by having him completely CGI'd. And I was just so upset.
Oh, wow, that's amazing. So to get a stuntman and dip him in green paint, nude, and then they use electricity
we're
money.
We're talking that it's amazing the process, not stripping a stuntman naked and dipping him in green paint.
Yeah, well, that's what George Lucas would do, and because George Lucas
Isn't
would
it
do it,
just the load of
that
motion capture dots.
Correct.
So I didn't think there was any stripping involved.
Yeah, I don't think they do that, Chris.
It might not be necessary for the technology, but it's probably how George
I
Lucas does it.
I will say that I think that they've either...
Okay, so on the Rogue... What was it called? Rogue One, the Star Wars film. They did a CGI of a young Carrie Fisher, right? It was awful. You know, there's that phenomena called Uncanny Valley, where you know, they have a puppet or a generated person, and it's fine if it's clearly not a person, and it's fine if it looks exactly like a person. But Uncanny Valley is where it looks uncomfortably like a person, but you can tell it's not quite a
all
person.
All I'm going to say, though, is I'll be a lot more freaked out if James Dean, 70 years after he's supposed to be dead, comes out in a film. You know, that would just totally freak me out.
Yeah, people don't really like, the world's not ready to basically resurrect somebody. And the thing is, CGI is not good enough. And I think it's not rational.
What's got me is that,
I just don't like the sound of it.
Matters on the news at the moment in terms of coronavirus. But, you know, it went quiet very, very quickly. You know, on IMDb, I don't know if it's still on there, but for a long time it did say that he was going to be in this film called Finding Jack. And the release was meant to be 2020 or 2021. And, you know, it has gone very quiet on that. So I don't know if it fell through, but no one felt the need to really talk about it because there was other stuff going on. But, yeah, I just thought it was terrible.
I think there was quite a backlash, wasn't there, from that news report?
Yeah, I remember celebrities like Chris Evans and that were all tweeting saying it was a disgrace. And
well, I just feel sorry if they do go ahead with it, if the guy who plays James Dean doesn't get a credit.
Yeah, because Chris Evans in one of his tweets was saying, like, you know, it's hard enough for an actor to get a job, let alone if you're competing with dead actors. So. But this is our last episode. We've gone on nice and long today, and I hope that, you know, it's so nice that so many people have stuck with us all this time. And we really enjoyed it. There's more than
all 10 of them. I mean, wow. Can you go over the stats?
Because that just sounds like us talking about, you don't talk about production stuff on air.
Don't worry. I think I'm a high functioning autist, so I just didn't get that aspect. Yeah, it's a good idea not to talk about stats on there. We have very good stats. We have the best stats. Okay. India, China, they're saying to us, how do we get your stats so good? And what we're saying is,
we just
have the best stats.
I'm trying to remember if we were married when you started the podcast. I don't think you... No, well, that's a news flash.
No, we weren't married, Mark.
We were engaged. We were... Yeah.
The podcast,
it might be possible someday.
We've got married and expecting our first child. Chris has got his first house. You know, we've had a pandemic. We've had three lockdowns.
We are having a pandemic.
Yeah, exactly. We've survived COVID.
Yes, we're having a pandemic.
Yes. Mostly. You know.
But
we survived COVID mostly. I'm sorry.
So, anyway.
Let's move on.
Move on. We'll be bringing up a little newborn soon, so
anything's possible.
We'll have to see how parenting goes.
Yeah, Chris.
And on that note, I wish you the very best of luck and
bonkers.
It's amazing, isn't it? I have to get you a baby gift as well.
Chrissy.
I don't know what to get you.
Well, anyway,
I don't do babies. You know.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I think I could get
whatever you like.
Always
very greatly appreciated. But we're gonna say goodbye now, listeners. Bye bye.
Not just by now.